Hello, it's Wednesday 10th of March. I'm Hannah Pearson from Peer Anderson. On this week's show, Gary Bowerman from Check in Asia and I will be debating the vital learnings for travel and tourism from the pandemic year.
Yeah, 1 year ago, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 a pandemic. We all know what happened next, but what have we learned? Let's find out over the next 30 minutes. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. So tomorrow, 11th of March, marks a full 12-month cycle since the world entered into a pandemic. But what have we learned here in Southeast Asia, and how can those lessons be best applied?
Yeah, Hannah, history will look back on this period, and I guess at the moment we don't quite know how it will be fully interpreted. But from a current standpoint, I think two things are clear. Number one is that international travel and tourism is in a desperate state. And number two, the industry as a whole hasn't really been able to find the solutions required to escape from the darkness, not yet. So we've collated a list of 10 of the most important learnings from the past year. So Hannah, let's kick off with number one, which is the most important, and that is...
No one was prepared. Were they? No one. Not the governments, not definitely not the tourism industry, probably not the general consumer. Nobody... basically knew how to approach this pandemic and what to do. And any decision that was or wasn't made 1 year ago, you know, has had ramifications still now. And all learnings really come back from those decisions that were made a year ago to open or close the borders.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we said this on the pod before, but scientists were warning of a potential pandemic of some kind. The warnings were there, the risk reports were written, but they seem to have got ignored. But if we rewind back to a year, I mean, if you remember what it was like a year ago, there was a sense of panic, wasn't there, around the world, particularly in China. China got hit very, very badly. There were, you know, thousands of cases there. It was starting to radiate, this outbreak, across Southeast Asia, across Asia Pacific, and then eventually worldwide. And by sort of springtime, you know, the case numbers in places like Iran, in Italy, in New York, you know, it was a desperately dangerous situation. And the calling of a pandemic, you know, the pandemic is a scary word, isn't it? We're used to that from, you know, disaster movies and that kind of thing. But that really encouraged governments around the world to take action and to basically lock down, to shut down their borders, to lock out travel. And from there, we haven't really recovered. You know, we're a year later. There are signs of springtime blooms in the air. The vaccinations are offering some semblance of hope. But there is so much red tape to get through, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it's like we've said many times, you know, it's been so easy to lock down. But the difficult thing is, how do you then unlock what you originally did? And that's, I think, the conundrum that governments are still trying to find their way out of right now, aren't they? And then there's no models for people to follow. There's no roadmap how to do it, just because the virus itself is very unpredictable. And we've seen these mutations, perhaps, you know, that was something that took people by surprise as well. And the fact perhaps some vaccines might not even be able to be particularly effective against those variations. And what does that then mean? It's really a very complex, very developing situation. And it has been that way since the get-go.
I mean, it's quite a unique situation in Southeast Asia when we look back, Hannah, you know, because it hasn't been as bad here as it has been in other parts of the world. I was looking at the actual official statistics, and the recovery rate, or the official recovery rate across ASEAN, across the 10 countries, is 89.4%, which is extremely high. And at the moment, 8.41% of total cases are active cases. So, you know, the death rate in this region has been extremely low, excepting probably Indonesia, maybe the Philippines too. But it's almost seems like it's controversial to say, but like a wasted year. We've locked down whole economies, and the outcome really is still pretty cloudy.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you're right that we've been incredibly lucky, I think, to be living in Southeast Asia, especially when you look at the situation in America or in Europe. and what's been going on there, that you said death rates are very low. You know, Laos has still had less than 50 cases this whole time. So some countries have really been massive, massive success stories. But you're also right in that, you know, just because they're a success story doesn't mean that they are successful tourism-wise. And that has been something that has inevitably suffered with all of these lockdowns, not just, of course, international tourism, which has been completely obliterated, but domestic tourism too, which has inevitably been affected by lockdowns, kind of provincial quarantines on one another, interstate travel restrictions. All of this has played a massive part in dampening domestic tourism demand too.
Which sets us up very nicely, thank you, Hannah, for point number two, which is the difference between travel and tourism. Now, over the past year, I don't think there has ever been as much written about the travel and tourism sectors as there has been during a period when very little has actually happened. We've been talking about it all year. But what we've really learned, and I think what governments in particular have learned, is just how different the definitions within the travel and within the tourism sectors actually are. Now, there's so you mentioned there, domestic travel, which has obviously taken the focus because borders and international travel have been mostly off limits in the past year. But then there are different concepts within domestic travel. There's business travel. There's a whole range of different elements within the business travel sector. You know, there's MICE. There's travel to make business deals. There's a lot of economic migration in our region. There's a lot of student travel, visiting family and friends, students who reside in other countries. So there's just been this whole, I think, a better understanding of where the travel and tourism sectors actually impact economies, which I've got a feeling people didn't realize before.
Yes, I think that people, you know, were very happy to take the dollars that tourism generated, but perhaps not so much in just how many workers, both formal and informal, rely on tourism for a living. And I think that this has very much shone a light on that. You know, I think perhaps before, informal workers, the rickshaw drivers, the people operating food stands outside a tourist attraction, were not really considered to be part of the overall tourism infrastructure. But governments have had to wake up and realize that yes, they are, and now they're missing vital income. And that, of course, affects society as a whole.
Yeah, absolutely. The interesting thing going forward will be to see how governments have learned that lesson, how they actually plan going forward, because our tourism economies in this region are quite state planned. How do we move out of this, and how do we make tourism more inclusive, but also less, the vulnerable parts of society aren't just precluded as soon as something difficult occurs, like a pandemic. How do we rebuild economies so that they become more inclusive?
Yeah, that's going to be the challenge, I think, going forwards. So our third learning is, and this is probably the biggest shock, I think, to a lot of tourism players, is adapting to the domestic market. So, you know, as we already said, domestic market. Before, of course, it has always been there. Domestic tourism has always been something that has been present in the region, but it has not been a focus, and particularly not a focus, I think, for many national tourism organizations who have preferred to look to inbound travelers, right, rather than planning necessarily for domestic travelers. But of course, when you have borders closed down, that's all that's left to you. So that's what you've got to make the most of. So we saw last year, you know, governments trying to adapt. And I think Singapore has been a good case for this, because, of course, Singapore had very little domestic tourism prior to this, because there's a limit, you know, how many staycations can you take? How many times can you go visit Sentosa? You go visit what are the other attractions there? But, you know, they launched this massive campaign, Singapore Rediscovers. They gave $100 in vouchers to every Singaporean to spend at, you know, hotel or tour operators or attractions. And they have seen some success with that. They have, you know, seen kind of an excess spend. So Singaporeans who are spending it tend to spend more than the $100 as well. They tend to be topping up. So that's, of course, generating revenue. And they are adapting to it, but because they have had no other choice.
Yeah, absolutely. That adapting point was really illustrated. I sat in on a webinar last week for the World Tourism Network. And there was a senior official from Tourism Malaysia who gave a pretty good presentation, actually. But he said it wasn't until they ran the figures last June, so June 2020, they ran the 2019 figures. And they actually discovered, they didn't know this, that in 2019, domestic tourism actually generated more income in total than inbound tourism. Now, it's astonishing that that wasn't known. It's not really a surprise because, you know, domestic tourism happens all the time. People take long weekends. A lot of people around Malaysia live and work in places where their families don't, so they tend to go back on weekends, that kind of thing. It really depends how you define what domestic tourism actually is. But, you know, it is a huge economic factor before the pandemic, and it will certainly be one afterwards. And that will be one of the key learnings, is what have countries learned about how people travel during a pandemic in their own countries? Will they continue to do that in the future? Will they diversify even more? You know, how do you actually allocate resources and planning to a domestic economy when you are really hoping that international travel comes back?
It's a tricky balance, isn't it? That, like you say, trying to develop the products and push the awareness for domestic tourists, but you've also got one eye on the prize, which are these international tourists who inevitably do generate, you know, big spend. But governments have got to do this because it is just not realistic, I think, to assume that international tourism levels are going to bounce back to what they were. It's not... it's unrealistic to presume that, you know, people perhaps are going to be as willing to travel internationally as they were before. Perhaps people are going to want to stick closer to home, and they may have more limited budgets. People have lost jobs. People have had pay cuts. Domestic travel is going to be one of the realistic alternatives to outbound travel, at least for the next couple of years, I imagine.
Yeah, there was a consumer survey done in Vietnam. I think it was last week or the week before. And the overriding mantra for the forthcoming months was safe and nearby. Travelers do want to feel safe, and they are unwilling to travel too far in the immediate period. As you say, we don't really know what will happen with international travel quite yet. But even in domestic terms, you know, I think there is this unwillingness to go too far. So, you know, there are a lot of challenges ahead, both for domestic as well as for international travel.
Yeah, I mean, and even if you look at the concept of public holidays, this is quite an interesting one across Southeast Asia, and different governments are taking different approaches this year. Because, of course, you know, if you have domestic holidays, often it will create a long weekend and that stimulates demand. On the other hand, we've also seen that long weekends tend to lead to a spike in cases as well. You know, this increase in domestic travel inevitably leads to higher transmission. So you have countries like Indonesia and the Philippines this year who have actually taken the decision to remove some annual leave from the calendar, whilst you've got ones like Thailand who are adding. They've added public holidays this year to stimulate domestic travel. So even the approaches of governments within Southeast Asia to how do you best stimulate domestic tourism is very divergent.
Yeah, which brings us on to number four, Hannah, and I'm going to ask you a question here. This is something we've talked about so many times over the last year, and that's travel bubbles. Now, we discovered last year that travel bubbles simply didn't work in the context and the time of last year. Much of that was to do with a disagreement over testing procedures and that kind of thing, but also the variants of the virus and just the volatile nature of the virus. But do you think they're a dead concept, travel bubbles, or do you think they can be resuscitated in the sort of vaccinated era?
It's a great question. I do think there's still some life in them left. I think we're still going to be talking about travel bubbles for a while yet. I mean, Singapore has said that they are still going to pursue this idea of travel bubbles, that they believe, I think, that a lot of international travel that will happen this year will be via travel bubbles of some sort. And to a certain extent, that makes sense, right? Because you perhaps, it might not be a one-to-one travel bubble. Perhaps it's more of a group, and you find those countries who have a common vaccination rollout, who have a common understanding perhaps of vaccination certificates, and you then agree to a mechanism of reopening. But then I suppose you could also argue, well, perhaps having a vaccination certificate might just negate all of that anyway. Maybe they just won't be needed because there will be different ways of reopening. What do you think?
Well, I agree with all of that. I think a lot of this does come down to who takes the lead and what the negotiations actually are, which actually brings us on to point five, Hannah. Let's get into the vaccine debate, because they overlap here quite significantly. So vaccines are here. I think we have about 11 vaccines approved, 11 or 12 around the world right now. There are a lot more coming online. Countries in our region include Vietnam and Thailand, which are actually developing their own. Taiwan also, in Asia Pacific as well, and many other countries. So we will have a lot of new vaccines over the next few months. But how do we plan for this? Now, you raised the issue there of digital health passes, vaccine passports, whatever we want to call them. We also have the issue in parts of the region where there is vaccine hesitancy. A lot of people are unwilling to take the jab initially, and sort of kind of watching and waiting just to see what the potential side effects are. But as they relate to travel bubbles and reopening, vaccines do present quite a few challenges. Now, it is going to require a lead being taken. We've seen recently that IATA is trying to do that. China this week has put its hat into the ring. You know, that China has huge leverage, particularly in Southeast Asia, if it wants to develop its own sort of regional health pass. I think some of these things are really coming to pass now. I was listening to an interview yesterday with Alexander Juniak from IATA, and he said that, you know, we have been developing this digital health pass, but his phrase was, we are not the only one, and it comes down to a sovereign decision. So countries will pick and choose, I guess, how they go forward, which means this will take a bit more time.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that Gary and I were discussing this before the podcast recording, that I don't really understand, because countries have talked about vaccines for probably a year now, right? Almost a year we've been discussing vaccinations, and that's been the goal. But it almost feels like nobody really thought out what would happen once vaccinations were starting to be rolled out. You know, why now? Is it only now that countries are starting to talk about, we're finalizing our requirements for vaccination passports? You would think that this would have been something that would have been discussed and talked about and thought through months ago, months before there was even a chance of the vaccination, so that things could roll out faster. But it doesn't seem to be the case.
Which links together points 4, 5, and 6. We're going to come on to number 6 now, because these are all linked together. So number 4 was travel bubbles, number 5 is vaccines, and number 6 is testing and quarantine. Because I think what we are really learning now, and you said this should have been discussed a long time ago and should have been negotiated, but testing is not going to go away. Even with vaccines, because of the nature of their rollout, it's going to take a lot of time. We're still going to require PCR testing before you fly, and probably when you arrive as well. But the elephant in the room is quarantines, isn't it? We have to somehow find a way to remove quarantines, because otherwise travel flows just aren't going to happen.
Yeah, exactly. And then, of course, it's the government weighing up how can they do that, but do that in a safe way? Because, of course, there's still not that definitive answer about whether vaccinations do stop transmission. Therefore, perhaps some kind of quarantine might still be needed. You know, how long are they efficient for? We had the news this week that Thailand this has still got to be approved centrally, reduce their quarantine period to 7 days from 14 days for those who are vaccinated. And in general, they're looking at reducing their quarantine, even for those who are not vaccinated, to 10 days. Now, Malaysia is already 10 days, actually, and we have not seen, I don't think, a significant increase in cases due to a reduced quarantine period in Malaysia, or at least that link has not been publicized, if there is one. So it is the ultimate disincentive, isn't it, for travel, quarantine. But how do you get around it? We were talking in our reopening episode last week about different models. Sri Lanka's got a repeated testing. And like you say, Gary, testing is going to play a huge, huge role. And to me, again, it's a little bit puzzling why governments are not investing more ways into making this testing more efficient, cheaper, more comfortable. Because if you got rid of those kind of barriers, and if it was cheap, and if it was very fast, and if it's as simple as spitting into a cup, people would feel a lot more comfortable with taking these kind of tests and therefore traveling.
Well, I couldn't agree more. And again, you set up our next point even better, which is number 7, which is, it does seem in Southeast Asia and parts of Asia at the moment that nations don't want to open up too fast. They want to be quite progressive. It's quite political in nature. Any opening that is going to happen is going to be some kind of bubble, isn't it? That there can have to be agreements between countries, because as we've discussed before, Bali tried this last September. You can't just say we're open if you don't have a market for people to arrive into your country. So there has to be agreements between countries to allow flows of travelers. The interesting cases that we've discussed before is the Maldives. You know, Maldives has just sped ahead. You know, its inbound arrivals numbers are really, really impressive over recent months. Seychelles is opening up later this month, again, an island destination. Qatar Airways has said this week that it's going to ramp up frequencies into Seychelles. So these island destinations have just a much easier way into a future than countries with land borders and the complex political nature of ASEAN, I think. I think one of the problems here is who opens up with who doesn't open up with who. It's going to get very messy, I can see, unless there is leverage from China or India.
Yeah, it's incredibly political, I think. And definitely countries across Southeast Asia are all watching each other to see what each other are doing. I mean, even the Thai Prime Minister said last week that Thailand would be in line with other countries. So there is that keeping an eye on what each other are doing. But, you know, ultimately, there would be a massive competitor advantage for one of the Southeast Asian countries if they did open up and if they did find a way to open in a kind of controlled way. They would have that big advantage over other rival nations, because Southeast Asia is an attractive place to visit. I think it is still at the top of people's wish list, particularly because it has handled COVID very well. It doesn't have that kind of bad reputation hanging over it for its handling. It's perceived as pretty safe. But the massive thing, of course, that we're saying is quarantines and the fact that there seems to be no real roadmap about how borders are going to reopen or timelines for when that might happen.
Yeah, referring back to the interview I was talking about earlier with Alexander Juniak from IATA, he made an interesting point. He said that what IATA is pressing for, and we don't know what lobbying leverage it actually has, but it says it wants countries to have a reopening plan that is consistent with their vaccine program. He said the two countries that are leading this at the moment are the UK and Germany. He said that both countries have actually aligned the way that they're rolling out vaccines to how they actually plan and have set out roadmaps to open up travel again in future. Now, that's quite an interesting case, because if you look back at 6 months ago, and we've both criticized the UK's handling of COVID-19 extremely, you know, we've criticized it a lot, justifiably. But it does seem to have a handle on how it actually wants to use vaccines to reignite the economy and also travel. We don't get that sense. Perhaps China. I think we're starting to see some dropped hints and also some actual official movements in China. But China will need other countries to move with it. It'll have to leverage the way that happens. It comes to me that I don't see much movement between ASEAN unless there is one of the major players pushes it along.
Yeah, I mean, I think Singapore could be the catalyst. They might be the leader. They're certainly the one with the most travel agreements right now, the most progressive ideas. Perhaps they can lead the way, but like we keep saying, Singapore is almost a different case. It's very easy to control the borders there. It's a very small country. It doesn't have the problems that Philippines or Indonesia with thousands of islands faces.
Yeah, absolutely. Which brings us to number 8 on our list, and that's the problems of actually reanimating travel because of the problems that the airlines have.
The last year or so, we've seen airlines massively cut their schedules, cut their employees, cut their routes. How do you then go back from that to cater for the demand? And of course, as an airline, you've got to be realistic. It costs a lot of money to fly a plane empty. So they have got to really carefully balance and calibrate that demand with the supply as well, because if they get it wrong, it could be catastrophic. And a lot of these airlines are teetering on the edge. Many have still not received financial assistance or support from the government 1 year on, and they are relying on the domestic market. A lot of them have done very well in terms of opening up new domestic routes, connecting markets that were never connected before within countries. But how do they then change everything back to international?
Yeah, one of the things that we are definitely seeing, my inbox is starting to get full, my messaging apps the same, is airlines are starting to roll out, you know, quite longer term promotions. I think, to kind of test what actual demand will be. You know, what, how are they going to plan? They're not going to be able to plan for a recovery until they know what actual consumer demand is going to be like to fly again. So I get the feeling that they're putting out these, in some cases, you know, they're quite enticing discount promotions or long-term passes, you know, year passes or whatever, just to try and find out what the sentiment actually is. It's okay surveying people and finding out, you know, would they like to travel if. But it's actually where they put their money. You know, if you put your money where your mouth is, you're actually prepared to buy a ticket that you can use over the next year or the next 6 months, that gives a much more rounded view of the market demand, which airlines are going to have, because they've basically got no data to work with. As you said, you know, they've slashed staff, pilots and crew are furloughed, their planes are still parked. They've got to find a way out of this, which can't be done overnight. Some of the airlines that have been flying in recent months, you know, you look at Qatar, you look at Emirates, they seem to be in the gun position here because they have actually been operating. But in terms of the regional airlines that we really need to reanimate, the AirAsias, you know, these kinds of airlines, it's going to be difficult to scale back up.
It is. And I think perhaps the one exception might be Vietnam, which has had a really, really strong aviation market. And actually two of the airlines there, Bamboo Airways and Vietjet Air, I think are some of the few airlines in the world who made profit last year. You know, everybody else is in massive losses. They actually made a profit. But even in Vietnam, airlines are asking for financial aid. And it's coming to that point now where if they don't get it soon, they are going to have to make those really big permanent cuts that are going to impact travel when it comes back.
Which, again, you set this up, leads us into point number 9, which is we are at the point where economic panic is setting in. It's not just airlines, it's economies. One of the reasons that we're starting to see governments begin to make movements on this is because they need to get their economies moving again. We talked already about China. Now, China, over the past 6 to 8 months, has really reanimated its domestic travel economy. Business travelers are flying around the country. There is a degree of leisure travel around the country as well, although the last Chinese New Year holiday was a little bit subdued. But the problem for the airlines is they don't make really very much money for domestic routes. They need to get those international routes up and running again, because the three big Chinese airlines have all registered quite significant losses towards the end of last year. So they need to get flying as much as anybody else. And you know, they will rely, I think, in the early phase on regional routes into Northeast Asia, Japan, Korea, down to Hong Kong and into Southeast Asia. Perhaps at the moment, Australia, New Zealand might be out of bounds. But, you know, there is this economic need to get things moving.
Yeah, we've seen GDP absolutely tank across Southeast Asia. Many countries have had the worst GDP decline in 2020 on record. Countries are very acutely aware right now that they need to revive the economy. And countries like Singapore are very, very switched on that to do that, they have to reopen travel.
The GDP figures tend to sort of, you know, they provide an umbrella of what the difficulties actually are. But on the ground, you know, the losses of livelihoods, the losses of jobs, businesses going bust, you know, this stuff is going to take time to reanimate and to revitalize. And that can't really begin until borders start to open.
And so our last point then, number 10, is how to deal with the environment going forward. And I think we've learned that travel and the travel industry in general has to take this seriously.
Yeah, it's a massive issue. I think once the pandemic starts to subside, you know, the global focus will definitely be on the climate crisis, because it is absolutely staring everybody in the face. We kind of avoided the fact that a pandemic was coming. Before the pandemic, there were moves towards trying to mitigate plastic trash, plastic waste in the oceans, the poisoning of marine life. But there are other bigger issues, the degradation of land masses simply because overdevelopment and resorts are too big, there's coastal erosion, those kinds of things. I think they're going to become in the crosshairs over the coming months. And of course, the airline sector as well. You know, the carbon emissions have definitely been down in recent months because of less planes have been flying through the air. Those figures will go back up again. This year, there is a major international environmental summit, which is taking place in Scotland, which follows up towards the next movement towards the Paris Accord ratification and 2030, when all those emissions cuts that everybody promised to make have to come into place. Most countries around the world haven't really followed through on that. So I think that, you know, travel is going to become in the crosshairs because there is going to be a huge, huge push towards reducing carbon emissions, greenhouse gases. But yesterday I was watching a TV program and there were some divers in the Philippines that were off the reefs. I'm not sure where it was in the Philippines, but absolutely beautiful. And they showed just how many face masks have been discarded over recent months have found their way into waterways and into the oceans, and they're just clogging up the reefs. And it really, really shows you that what's happened over the last year, you know, there's a lot of plastics that we didn't realize have been discarded, and they're causing more damage than before. So we've definitely gone into reverse on that one.
Yeah, I mean, like you say, this is going to be the new crisis for the tourism industry. And this time right now is really a time for the tourism industry to get ahead and think about how they can start handling this, how they can start contributing positively to these kind of issues. And they have to, you know, we're going to go from one crisis, unfortunately, I think, to another fairly quickly. So now is the time for some serious soul searching. And, you know, everybody always says a time for a reset of how tourism could be and should be.
It's not going to be just about avoiding the politics of this, avoiding, you know, the economics of that kind of thing. I have a feeling that consumer mindsets have changed a little bit over the last year. And, you know, we've all had time to reconsider what travel means to us, how we think about our own carbon footprints and that kind of thing. Now, not everybody will have done that, of course, but I do think if you look at the way consumers are purchasing at the moment, there is a stronger focus on things like biodegradable packaging and that kind of thing. Now, there is a movement towards protecting our natural resources more than there was before, and travel and tourism will definitely have to take that into account. So, Hannah, that brings us to the end of this week's Pandemic One Year On edition of the show. We hope that you enjoyed the podcast, and don't forget to send us your thoughts and comments on what we discussed or what we missed out. Drop us an email at hello@thesceasiatravelshow.com or message us on our LinkedIn page at the Southeast Asia Travel Show or on Twitter at SEA Travel Show.
Meanwhile, you can catch up with the Southeast Asia Travel Show's full back catalogue on our website, theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Pocket Casts, Castbox, Overcast, Podcast Addict, and Stitcher. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show on each one. And if you do listen to us on Apple Podcasts, give us a review, please, and that will help other people find the show.
Yeah, it sure does. So that's a wrap for this week. Hannah and I are both off to prepare our presentations for next week's ASEAN Tourism Research Association Annual Forum, which we're both speaking at. We'll tell you more about that next week. And we look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism very soon.